KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture on the Hearsay Culture Network and KZSU. My name is Dave Levine. I'm Associate Dean and Professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at Stanford's Center for Internet and Society, the University of Milan's Information Society Law Center, and the University of North Carolina's Center for Information Technology and Public Life. I go to conferences, which is what academics do. And I primarily go to meet people and to listen to what they have to say, but first really to meet people. And so our mutual friend, Brett Frischman of Villanova, could not believe that I had never met our guest today, Richard Witt, the author of Reweaving the Web, How Together We Can Create Human-Centered Internet of Trust. A human-centered internet of trust is probably something that I could have used as a subtitle for Hearsay Culture when I launched it nearly 20 years ago when I was a fellow at Stanford, because the internet itself was launched with a very utopian vision of what the capabilities were of connecting people technologically, right? Very famously, we have the original founders of this vision thinking about an open, easily accessible network that anyone could join as long as they had a computer. They didn't need permission to join it, and they weren't even told what to say or do. Here you are, here's your technology, and in that utopian concept, the idea was people would be connected, people would get to know each other better, and people would therefore have a better understanding of each other. That vision of the internet remains today. However, it has been tortured. Tortured by human beings, tortured by corporations, which are created by human beings, and tortured by the nature of humans as being imperfect. And so while we have seen much of that connection flourish, we had the Arab Spring of 10 plus years ago that allowed people to speak out of repressive countries where governments were trying to not just destroy the internet, but destroy humanity in a lot of ways, use the internet to inform the world as to what was happening. Of course, people have connected on the internet through any number of interests, both legal and illegal, sadly, and found communities, right, to support their creative efforts and also, sadly, to support criminal activities. But what we've also seen more fundamentally is a shift in how people think about technology and what people see as the benefits of technology. And public information and public data over the last 10, 15 years through surveys, through empirical studies and so forth, unfortunately shows an increasing number of people do not view the internet positively. And in fact, an increasing number think it would be better off if we didn't have it. So what to do about a problem like that? Enter Richard's work through GLIA, which we are going to talk about. I'm going to let him define it and even talk about what it means. And his very, very interesting and well-researched, which, by the way, for people who aren't professors, right, is not often seen. And so that is a compliment from Hearsay Culture and from me. And also very interestingly designed with different colored pages and cartoons and ways to really engage people, fundamentally getting at the question of, okay, these are where the problems are. So what do we do about it? And what we do about it is a proposal that Richard is going to talk about here to rethink, or as he puts it, reweave the web in a way that gets back to those ideals, while I think recognizing the functional reality of the world in which we operate, which, by the way, means making money on the internet is not a bad thing. Richard has a background at Google. Not making money on the internet should be an option too. And so from the perspective, not just of creators, but of users and policymakers, Richard has a fascinating book here that I think is well worthy of our time, recording as we are on July 10th, 2025, as we face a variety of challenges, but opportunities through a technology, which is now a second banana sort of to AI, which we'll also talk about a bit, because of course we have to talk about AI if we're talking in 2025. So we'll talk about that as well. Richard has an extensive background both in the corporate world and as an attorney. Currently, he serves as a fellow in residence with Mozilla, a senior fellow with Georgetown's Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, and as a co-founder of Gleonet Primer LLC. He's an 11-year veteran of Google from 2007 to 2018, where he most recently served as Google's corporate director for strategic initiatives, working with Vint Cerf, Hal Varian, and other Googlers on policy and ethical issues. Prior to that, he also worked at Motorola and a variety of other companies. Richard is joining us via Zoom today on July 10, 2025. Richard, thank you for joining me on Hearsay Culture. And thanks to Brett for putting together and Mike Madison for putting together a great conference around the Global Knowledge Commons where we got an opportunity to meet.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for that kind introduction. And I also kudos as well to Brett. The work he's been doing on the Knowledge Commons is its own separate foray into how do you bring legitimate trust back into the internet. So the work that he and other the scholars who are at that conference is really germane to the kind of conversation we're having today. But I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today, talk about my book a little bit, talk also about this coalition of for-profit startups here in the Valley that I've assembled, who are trying to take these principles from the page into the real world in terms of ethical business models and practices and policies that actually try to build out authentic trust with their customer base. So happy to go through that and all the other, I think, important questions of the day.
Yeah, I think you just hit my first question. So go ahead, expand on it, both GLIA and also that current work that you're doing.
Yeah, well, and if we can step back a little bit, and your intro got into some of this, the original internet, and the book does go through a little bit of this history, just enough to give people the flavor. I don't want to bog people down into the puts and takes of all the working groups and the engineering and the like. But the original internet was, in some ways, the most radical invention of the 20th century, because it came out of the academic world, of course, also the military. So it came from this unusual space where pure peer-to-peer networking had never existed before, right? We had basically what had been thought of as sort of the smart networks in the middle, the phone companies essentially, and then the dumb terminals, the phone devices that we would pick up and use to call somebody. And the internet completely reversed that. The core of the internet, the backbone, became this hugely simplified thing using protocols like TCP/IP, which my friend and mentor, Vint Cerf, helped to create with Bob Kahn back in 1974 and onward. And then all the intelligence resided at the edge with every one of us. Each one of us was a node in the original internet. And because of that, we had the capability to represent our own interests, to communicate, to share information. Again, a hugely radical way of thinking about that technology. What changed then was in the early 90s, the advent of the World Wide Web. So Sir Tim Berners-Lee correctly said, you know what, this is all great, but people need a simpler way to connect rather than using, you know, sort of engineering degrees to figure out how these nodes would attach and how to connect with people. And so the web was introduced, HTTP, on top of the internet. You can think about it as sort of a layer sitting on top of the net. And that introduced things like browsers and servers, and other sort of instrumentalities, functionalities that made it much easier for the average person to interact. That was great, but as the book walks through, it also introduced some new vulnerabilities, which a variety of companies took advantage of, things like cookies and other ways that they start tracking people on the web. And we can get into a lot of the detail if you'd like to, but that sort of was the original sort of sin of, as it were. And ironically, Sir Tim, since that time in the past 5 or 6 years, he's been talking very openly about, yeah, the web is where things went astray. My bad. Mea culpa. He's building out some functionalities with something called Solid, a project he's launched to help try to take care of that. That's one of many, many things that we can talk about here. But yeah, that's sort of, I think, the framing is to say the internet, the original internet, very cool, very interesting, very radically transformative in terms of empowering us. The web came along, and then people took advantage of the power of the web to start creating these sort of countercurrents with the cloud technologies and other things. And again, we can get into some of the details there.
Yeah, I mean, it brings us right to your book, right, and to your project. So, you know, rather than throwing in the towel, it seems like you're coming to us with a radical vision, really, of reinventing, or as you call it, reweaving the web. What do you mean by reweave in the context of what you're proposing?
Yeah, so what I've come up with, and this is not original to me necessarily, Shoshana Zuboff wrote a great book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, where she went through chapter and verse of like talking to people and understanding at a deep level the product and engineering people who populated a lot of the web companies. And what I basically took from her work and then many others and my own experience at Google was something I call the SEAMS paradigm. So that's S-E-A-M. And very simply put, it is a set of feedback loops that the web companies over a period of years have installed in their networks through the cloud-based technologies they have. And it's four basic components. The first is surveillance. That's the S, right? And we have something like 80 billion connected devices out there today and more on the way every day, right? And those devices in many ways are in fact surveilling us using a variety of protocols and standards and interfaces. The second part then is extractive. So extracting personal data from us that's built on top of the surveillance technology. That personal data from anything from our biometrics, how we are, how we're interacting online today, to all the information about our intentionalities in the world, our preferences, our wants, our needs, all of that is fair game. The third part then is analysis, and that's really the algorithms. We've had AI for decades, right? We're now just calling it AI in a certain sense because ChatGPT and with has been out there now with OpenAI and made it a much bigger deal in people's minds. But we've had algorithms for a long time, just simple computational resources that delve into that data, churn through it, and create analyses, inferences, as it were, about the consumer or the user. And the final element of that is the M for manipulation, which 10 years ago, when I first came up with this notion, some people were like, wow, that sounds pretty harsh, manipulating people. But in fact, that's exactly what Shoshana came up with. That's what she realized in the conversations in the Valley. Yeah, these are attempts to not just sell you something, a product, for example, influence the way you think about things, influencing you with ideas, with perceptions about reality. We've seen that, of course, rampant through the social media networks. So I think that, again, I think that's a fair term to use. So the SEAMS cycles have now been put in place throughout all the different technologies that the major web platforms have today. And that has really led to the parade of harms that we see, all the things you referenced in at the outset. All of that really is at the core, this notion that the way that the platforms make money is to employ these feedback loops in ways to extract as much possible value, financial value, they can from us, seeing us 24/7 as consumers, as people who are always willing and able in their minds to buy something, whether it's purchasing a good or a service or an idea or in a perception or a political viewpoint, right? All that is fair game as far as they're concerned. So the book talks about that as the analysis of what the problem is. And oftentimes people just sort of stop there and say, okay, that's not great. We got to figure out, maybe we have to pass a law or we have to stop looking at a phone during dinner or something. But I was dissatisfied. I thought there has to be some more systemic way to get at the root of this and at least create a particular way of an alternative way of reweaving that infrastructure that's developed over the last two decades in ways that put us more in the driver's seat, that empower the average person in ways that we don't have available today.
Now, Richard, given your background at Google, right, it's an arc, right, of a career, which is somewhat unusual. It's one that I relate to, incidentally. When I graduated law school, I went to work in Manhattan and I worked for a firm that did work for major entertainment industry companies as a junior associate, but became concerned. This was at the turn of the century, right? Late 90s, early 2000s, and into about the mid 2000s, where I thought, I'm concerned about how companies are using intellectual property law. And so a lot of people said, boy, you went to the dark side because I went to work for Larry Lessig, right? And so in a sense, right? Is that a fair comparison in terms of being at Google for 11 years, or thereabouts, right? And then writing a book, which is certainly I wouldn't say a critic of Google, but certainly critical of Google and other technology companies in terms of how they think, as you just said, how they think about consumers, how they think about the internet, and maybe how they think about their responsibilities in the world.
Yeah, I try to be careful about this because I don't necessarily cast aspersions on particular individuals or particular companies, right? I'm much more interested in the mindsets. I'm interested in how they look at the world and how they take those perceptions and install them into the business models. So when I talk about the SEAM cycles, for example, I feel pretty comfortable and confident that is, in fact, the fabric that most of these folks are all looking at. And by the way, the AI companies, OpenAI, et cetera, they're doing the exact same thing. They're using the exact same playbook, right? We may not see it in some of the same ways. It may come across a little differently, but that ultimately is the same road they're marching down as well. So, you know, when I learned at Google, and a couple of quick things is this notion of userhood, right? So, right away, I you know, as a young lawyer, everybody was referred to the individuals as users, not as customers or clients or patrons. And I was sort of puzzled by that. And then I came to realize the notion of calling somebody user basically means that they have no inherent rights, that any rights they had were what were unilaterally granted to them by some very smart lawyers with some very long and long-winded terms of service policies and privacy policies posted on the website. Or, you know, click through cookie screens and nobody ever bothered to read. And so that was, you know, the lowest common denominator is you are a user, right? And the second thing I learned was, you know, there was this mantra inside the company that everything we do is for the user. The user is number one, user is primary, which sounded pretty good until I, sitting in a lot of the product and engineering meetings, I realized the subtext, which was unspoken, which basically said, and we know what's best for the user.
Yeah.
So it's not about asking the user what they want or need. It's more about, okay, we know what's best. We've got the business model, again, based on sort of the seams approach, and we're going to proceed with that. That said, I also have this conviction that over time, the platform companies themselves, ironically, have become trapped within this paradigm themselves. Google, for example, has tried for the last 4+ years to pull away from the third-party cookie world. So for those of you who don't know, a third-party cookie just basically is something that's on a website. So as you're moving from one website to another, the cookie follows you. And so it's a way for somebody who has no other, otherwise has no interaction with you or no direct connection with you, to essentially track you around the web. Yep. And that has been the basis for a lot of the concerns around surveillance capitalism, around the idea that they're tracking us and our, you know, all of our actions on the web, and finding that as a way to get at us and try to make us, again, buy stuff ultimately, or impose views on us. And so they've been trying to pull away from that because they've seen it creates its own regulatory headaches for them. A lot of the major advertisers actually don't like the third party cookie world. The major brands, et cetera, are not really bought into it the way they used to be. And yet they can't. They cannot figure out a way to get away from that world without causing consternation for one of the many different constituent groups that they work with. So, long way of saying to your question, I'm much more interested in, like, okay, I think I see where the problems are, the system that's been built and the way that people have bought into it. How do we pull away from that? So even potentially at some point, the web platform companies say, yeah, there actually may be a better world that we want to help build out there than the one that we helped, you know, foster for the last decade or two.
Have you gotten reactions from your former colleagues to Glia, which we'll talk about, but also to the book?
Yeah, well, we mentioned Vint Cerf earlier. So Vint, I talked to him, gave him an early draft of the book. And of course, he's still there. He's the vice president, the chief internet evangelist is his great title. Yeah. And, you know, Vint was honest. He's like, you know, I work for the company. And yeah, you've been careful not to necessarily criticize the company, but there are things in here that could be viewed, you know, as problematic. And he said, what about this? If I just give you a quote, a supportive quote that says, you know, Richard is painting this really great vision of the world we should inhabit, and it's, you know, definitely thought-provoking. And I said, that's awesome, Vint, if you could give me that much. And so, as you may see, that's on the front yep. cover of the book.
Right.
Definitely thought-provoking. I've also have many, you know, many good friends among my former colleagues at Google who I see on occasion. And again, I don't get a lot of necessary pushback on what I'm trying to do here. As we'll get into in a moment, what I'm suggesting is not a mandate. It's not it's not essentially creating a whole vast new regulatory construct or, you know, a set of legal requirements. It is in fact a set of voluntary commitments by enterprises who think there's a better way of going about interacting with their customers, right? And but also doing so in a very commercially, you know, business-like manner, very successful as a matter of doing business. And so it's not necessarily imposing huge restrictions on them. It's not suggesting, you know, breaking them into 7 pieces, which of course many people are out there talking about. And so, you know, I think they have at least indicated to me that the vision I've created and also like the steps necessary to get there are not necessarily things averse to, you know, the long-term health of the web.
We're chatting with Richard Witt, author of the book Reweaving the Web, How Together We Can Create a Human-Centered Internet of Trust on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. And you know, I like to remind people who aren't in the Bay Area that if you're listening on old on the old radio, this is being beamed straight into Mountain View. So hopefully some people there are listening. Let's come back to this manipulation idea, because it really is at the center of your book. And obviously, it's a big discussion today in the context of not just the internet, but generative AI and AI, which we'll talk about shortly. But you know, in the book, you define manipulation, and again, wonderfully cited. I want to be clear. I'm saying this really to anyone who wants to use this book as a research tool. I think it's fantastic. You say M is for manipulating, influencing the user's outward behavior by altering how they think and feel. And then you make a point that I want to drill down on. You say, by focusing primarily on the user data flowing in one direction, we easily can overlook the direction of influence back at the user. Yet these cloud tech systems, right, that we're talking about, right, you know, any you know, as you know, as was as Larry Ellison famously said, the cloud is someone else's computer, right? I mean, just everything that's floating around out there, right? Yet these cloud tech systems both import reams of data and export many forms of influence. When you think about the influence that concerns you, what is the influence? I know manipulation's big, but that's not the only right way of manipulation, broadly speaking, right, that the internet impacts users. Are there other forms of influence that are more subtle that you think about as you think about reweaving the web?
Yeah, so one of the ironies here, if you talk to people who are sort of advocates for the web and for like the open, for example, the openness of the web, right, wanting to try to keep governments and large corporations from imposing restrictions on how the web operates, particularly in countries outside the United States, that focus is really around this idea of people should have the right to sort of have one big web that they all interact with and they all can see. And yet, as I talk about in the book as well, we don't have one web anymore. Each one of us sees a different web. Everything that I see on the web is uniquely geared towards me. It's different from the one you're interacting with because it's been constructed out of browsers, which are connected to websites and applications on the phone. All of that has been built in a way that caters to what our particular psychological and sort of personal profile reflects back on, you know, again, on these companies. And it's particularly done it in a way that, as I mentioned, sees us as a 24/7 consumer. Doesn't see us as a citizen, as an individual. It sees us as ultimately a wallet that they're attempting to pull money out of, right? And so the things that are aimed at us in terms of, you know, again, sort of the ideas, the perceptions and all that, that already is creating a warping effect, right? It's creating an interactive online space that brings that to us. And the, you know, some of the best examples, of course, are this idea of the algorithms that want to drive extreme behaviors. Because when you have opinions that go on websites and you have trolls out there pushing it, now you've got AIs, of course, pushing these extreme viewpoints, it engages people. It makes you angry, right? It gets you frustrated. It makes you, you know, want to engage and push back and say, no, it's this, no, it's that. But what they're doing is creating this dichotomy, this very sort of black and white sense of what reality is. The nuance sort of goes away in this particular way of that they've created because that doesn't benefit them. What benefits them is it's the more engagement they have, more you get involved, the more you press buttons and all, you're building more profiles, you're building more opportunities for, again, the people want to sell you stuff to get in there and try to do that. So it creates wedges in our society. And of course, those wedges do exist. We all have different opinions and all that. I would submit that it deepens those wedges and in fact creates this perception that the other person on the other side perhaps is sort of less human than me because their viewpoint seems so crazy to what I think the world looks like. So I think, you know, and you can see this obviously in politics today. I say, you know, the web didn't create the declining trust in institutions, you know, and the political systems all around us and the cultural systems we inhabit, the news environment, entertainment environment, but it has absolutely exacerbated it. It's made it worse. And so that's the part where I feel like we need to get it at the root of that, because ultimately, if we don't, that wedging is just going to continue. And I think the society and all of us individually as members of society will suffer accordingly.
Well, and of course, it begs the question why even the creators of the technology would want a world like that. Is it just simply that that's what's profitable is one answer, but there might be more to it. You spend a lot of time in the book appropriately talking about data, right? And data flows. And one of the points you make that I want to mention is, you quote a number of scholars that more or less talk about how human beings, right, are to the technological world and companies, right, data sets, right? And the amalgamation of data sets is what brings them value. And what you point out, which I think is really important that I want to ask you about, right, is what we do about being data, right? Or just being a data point on the web. And so one of the points you make, and I think it's a very timely one, right, is to raise the question of why there can't be, wait for it, right, a sharing of that value in a more equitable way. Now, for those that are listening, right, I'm going to use all the political terms that are misused today, right? I don't read Richard as suggesting, God help us, socialism, right? And I say that cynically. Nor is it communism. It's a matter of rethinking the relationship. You write, the best counterpoint that some advocates can muster is to claim that users should share in the monetization of the data of those assets, data being property. Is that where you see the future of the internet going in a way that brings back the values that the founders of the internet sought, that Tim Berners-Lee and others, right, have said are gone? Is the solution really in harnessing the value of data in a more equitable way?
Yeah, in the book, I try to go back to the basics and the very beginnings of this, even the notion of using the term data, because there are a lot of, I think, very well-meaning people out there, as you've already alluded to, who talk about, well, it's your personal data, quote unquote. You should just be able to share that with other people. You should be able to extract more value from it. Make Mark Zuckerberg send you a $7 check every month for the value he's getting out of what he's extracting from you, right? But I try to go back to the basics and say, wait a minute, what is data? Why are we, in a sense, using a terminology that comes from computer science that, in past decades was used to apply in different ways to different attributes of reality? And now today we all seem to sort of have assumed, yeah, I've got personal data. Well, that's what somebody else has defined for me. Why is that right? Why should I just sort of assume that whatever the way they are using this term data and then applying it to certain elements and attributes of me as an individual, as a human being, why is that okay? So I think we should at least step back a bit, and first, I think we should question the very premise of what data is. Again, in the book, I talk a bit about, data is ones and zeros. It's a very black and white, way digital, right, way of looking at the world. One can argue reality, of course, is analog, and it's all flows, and it's it, there's much more to reality in a sense than what a digital picture, whether it's a digital picture of the landscape or me as an individual, can necessarily ascribe that there are differentiations there that I think we shouldn't lose. So, as I say, we don't want to let lose the human in the process of defining us by data.
Well,
But then beyond that,
what would that differentiation be, right? Because I could see listeners, particularly in the Bay Area, saying, "Wait a minute, Richard, right? The reason why it's data is because the internet is a bunch of computers that are connected together, right? And we move bits and packets and data. I'm doing it very loosely, but you understand what I mean, right? And
Yeah, for
so,
sure.
no, that's exactly what we are on the internet, right? Because it's computers. Is there a better term than data that we should be using?
Well, I coined the term life stream in the book, which is to try to view things more, I can use the term organically, right? More the way that nature actually, looks at things the way nature is. Nature's not digital, right? You can go back to things like, oh, well, DNA and whatever. Of course, there are elements, attributes of the infrastructure of life, as there are to the infrastructure of the web, that are digital for sure. But that's the bearer, what I call the bearer circuits, for the things that we put on top that we actually care about, that actually we see and feel and taste and touch in our daily environment. So by calling it life streams in the book, I tried to pull us away a bit from that idea And then the other thing is that, you know, the web, because of the seams approach, right? This paradigm, these feedback loops, right? It puts us all in a series of transactions. You know, there's a seller, there's a buyer. Oftentimes we're not a willing buyer, but whatever. They'll try to get whatever they can out of us. It's a very sort of a one-sided approach, a very limited market-oriented approach, if I could put it that way, or maybe modern capitalist version of things. It's an extractive approach. And so seeing everything as a transaction, yeah, data sort of works there because then as you noted it, you can just basically see it as property, right? As something no different than a shale of oil that you want to go get some equipment and dig out of the ground. What I suggest in the book is one of the ways to reweave the web is to, again, pulling back to the basics is well, maybe life is less transactional, at least, you know, not all the time transactional. It's relational. It's about me and you and other human beings interacting. And that was part of the original utopian vision, if you want to put it, of the internet and the early web, was it was a way for people to communicate, share information, share viewpoints, entertain each other. It was relationship. Right, where you had the ones and zeros and the digits and all of that. But again, that was the bearer circuitry, the thing on the top, the thing that had the most human value were those interactions. And so one of the suggestions in the book is just getting away from the transactional nature of the web and thinking in terms of life streams, but also those life streams are things that are not just mine, they're yours and many other people's. And so it also allows us to think more socially, to think about how my quote data interacts with your data and somebody else's in ways that are not, again, not adequately captured, I think, by the existing paradigm and certainly by the machinery that we're using with the web, you know, in terms of the extractive technologies, the interfaces, and the like. So I just try to make this a more humanistic, not to use, again, an overly used term, I think, here, a more humanistic gloss on the technology, because frankly, I think that's where most of us, that's the world most of us live in. And I'd like to think a good chunk of us want to live in the future. Not one defined for us in these more narrow, cramped terms. You are data, you are a set of transactions, and our job as a company is to extract maximum value from you for our shareholders. That's what we've had for the last 20 years, and I think we can do better than that.
And we're going to talk about that after our quick break on KZSU-FM Stanford and the Hearsay Culture Network. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations to continue its operations. This is a very challenging time for universities and also for many people in our economy. And so I don't say lightly that we would value any donations you can make by reaching out at donate@kzsu.stanford.edu. Similarly, Hearsay Culture Network is one that requires revenue in order to continue its operations. So I do encourage you to reach out to us at hearsayculture.com and you can click donate on our website. Richard, let's turn to what that vision is. And then I want to double back on the topic du jour, although I think it's a fair one, AI. So you have, as you transition in the book, because we talked about the foundations here, and it's roughly about half of the book. And then you enter part three, which you call empowering our virtual edges, right? And this concept of empowerment. You use a hypothetical person, Carla, and you use a real world tragic event, COVID, to help us understand what those solutions might look like. Share with my listeners a little bit who Carla is in terms of the story that you tell involving data and the challenges and how that leads to a solution, part one. Part two is what we learned from COVID in the context of the solutions that you come up with.
Yeah, so Carla is a fictional character, and I actually have her in two parts of the book. As you mentioned, the middle part is roughly in the COVID era, 2020, when she's first contracts the disease, and then she's online and trying to figure out like what's happening, and she's besieged by disinformation, misinformation, and all of that. And then later in the book, towards the end, I reintroduce her in the year 2032, when hopefully what I have proposed here is actually in place. And she, in fact, is more empowered. So, of course, what happens in between is how I lay out sort of my theory of change, the proposed roadmap, and all that. But the core element here, and again, going back to the basics, we have what we have today in the web because we have very discrete power asymmetries between those who have the online resources and the expertise. It's the web companies and the rest of us, right? They have the deepest pockets that have ever been created in history, hundreds of billions of dollars floating around the world, trying to avoid taxes in many cases. They've got the smartest folks, marketers, and all of that, engineers, building stuff to try to use the seam cycles against us. So that creates this immense asymmetry between them and us. What I discovered as I was doing research and trying to figure out how do you get away from this notion of userhood so people have more power on the edges is the common law of fiduciaries. And so what I came to realize going back
Can you
a
define that
thousand
very
years ago,
quickly, just for non-lawyers, common law
yeah, well, so
fiduciaries?
a fiduciary is basically, and I was going to say this goes back to the common law of England, but in fact, you know, this is actually a common notion, even under different terms, in cultures all over the world. Simply stated, if somebody has power over you, that power that you lack for two reasons. One, because they have an expertise that you do not have. And two, by making yourselves vulnerable to them, maybe by sharing information with them, they can use that expertise to help you to improve your life. The single best example I can point out is a medical doctor, right? But we also have lawyers who are fiduciaries. We have financial advisors. Even librarians have a certain fiduciary duty. So being a fiduciary means that that entity that has these duties, because they have this power over you, we need to sort of figure out a way of righting that imbalance. And by two basic sets of duties, one is the duty of care, which essentially says do no harm. People are most familiar with the Hippocratic Oath because that's, of course, the very opening premise of it. First thing you do no harm, right? That's an injunction going back to ancient Greece, right? And Hippocrates and how physicians were supposed to approach their patients. But folks often miss the second part of that, which is to say, oh, and the other thing is you're supposed to make the person better. You're supposed to use your expertise to promote their health in this case, right? Or if you're a lawyer, help give people advice so they can improve their, you know, their legal status or whatever's going on. Financial advisors, you're supposed to use it in ways that, you know, give me more resources as opposed to take more money away from me or try to trick me or cajole me to do something else. So it's a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. The duty of loyalty means have no conflicts of interest between me and somebody else. So the doctor hopefully is not giving me a prescription because you got a kickback from a pharmaceutical company. Or he's going to say, yeah, you can't take that one because, you know, the insurance company won't allow me to tell you about it. Now, of course, we all know the world is not perfect, and those are absolutely, you know, pressures that come to bear. But yet those duties are absolutely paramount. Do no harm, have no conflicts. And the third part of loyalty is basically help promote my best interests, promote my health, promote my whatever, right? The particular field is. What occurred to me is that in the 21st century, here we now sit in 2025, we have nothing like that. We have no entities. We have no body of, you know, professional body that is out there acting on our best interests. We are completely on our own. We have no support system, as it were, to help us. And so what I thought was, well, you know what? Why not take these duties that have applied for hundreds of years in the common law, very well understood, and bring them into the world of personal data and now increasingly the world of AI, all right? Sort of put them in the mix and now find intermediaries who can act for me in trustworthy manners, take those duties on board. And now, for the first time, my data, quote unquote, again, going back to the idea of definition of that, my data now is something, a resource or a something that I want to have in the world that represents me. I can have AI agents that represent me, that don't represent Mark Zuckerberg, right? Or you know, the OpenAI folks. It's a whole shift in the balance of the power dynamic where you have an intermediary that sits in the middle representing my interests, bringing more power back to the edge of the network where I reside, away from the platforms. That is sort of the vision based on that premise that those are the fiduciary duties, common law, fiduciary duties and principles can in fact have a very healthy, create a new healthy dynamic in the web that hasn't existed to this point.
You know, implicit in your solution, Richard, and it's tough for two lawyers to have this discussion, is to suggest that regulation is not something we can rely upon effectively to
Yes.
achieve the goal. Yes, is that where you are?
Yeah. There are a number of very smart folks out there, scholars who've talked about something called information fiduciaries. So Jonathan Zittrain, Jack Balkin at Harvard have been talking about this for a while, off and on for the last 10 years. It's very interesting and very compelling, but ultimately what they're saying is that we should impose that as an obligation on the platform companies. And I've become persuaded that that's actually not the right way to go. We should certainly do what we can to improve the way they interact with us, But Tamar Frankel, who's a noted author and expert in the field of fiduciaries, had a very pithy quote. She said, "Forced loyalty is no loyalty at all." So if you turn a fiduciary duty essentially into a compliance matter, then, you know, the large platform companies just unleash their lawyers on it. They minimize it. They de-risk it. They do what they can to fritter away at the edges. It becomes something that they try to do the minimum necessary to comply with rather than embrace, because as we can talk about in a moment, because it's not just ethically sound, it's also really, really good business in terms of building trustworthy relationships with customers. So I've been persuaded that making this not a legal or regulatory mandate, but instead a voluntary commitment by companies who have the foresight to see this as a market differentiator is the better way to go. So the book lays out what that would look like. And then, as I mentioned at the outset, that's also the coalition of companies I'm working with that we're trying to build together.
And I do want to come back to that coalition towards the end of the show. But I'm going to take you up on what you just said, right? Which is, why aren't the companies doing this then, right? I mean, you know, I mean, this has been a struggle really since time immemorial. Hey, there's a better way to have a relationship with your customers, with the public, right? That gets you where you want to be. My theory, because I try to avoid the couple, oh, it's just, you know, it's all about money. I mean, that plays a big role. I'll use a nerdy phrase, pathway dependence, right? I mean, my general view of why a lot of this happens is, well, this is how we do things. It's hard to make change, and it's working for me, and so therefore, why bother? But what's your theory? I mean, you make a compelling case for doing things very differently, because again, you're not saying, and by the way, right, you don't make money, you're not successful. I mean, it's none of that, right? It's just having a system which, wait for it, seems to benefit everyone well. So why don't we get there? Putting aside law, why don't we get there?
Well, I think some of the forays into this sort of information fiduciaries world have happened more or less the last 20, 25 years. And I talk about that. I go through some of the evidence there. And I think there were two basic business models that have been proposed and adopted by a number of well-meaning companies who wanted to sort of go down this road. One of them is this notion that people care about privacy. So we will create a company whose job it is to protect your privacy, make sure your personal data is kept behind a moat, as it were, put up, you know, all the walls to keep out the bad guys, right? And that's a compelling enough reason for people to want to use the services. You can think about sort of like LifeLock, for example, something like a LifeLock service, but this is for your personal data, you know, exclusively. And then the other model is this idea that, oh, we're going to monetize your data. So we talked about this a bit at the outset. You know, we're going to find ways that the people who are already using your data today will pay you for it, because they should, and because financially it makes sense that the data you have is valuable enough to them that therefore somebody should be able to send you a check every month. And so those were sort of the two basic approaches, what I call privacy and monetization, towards having an intermediary there to help you, to support you, to sort of give you even fiduciary-like sort of duties. And yet both of these models, as far as I can tell, have largely failed. And I think they have failed because, again, we look at this from one end of the telescope. We're looking at it from the telescope of the platform companies and from the notion of how you define data. And we're looking at it from like monetizing stuff, when for the most part, consumers don't care about that, right? What consumers care about is make my life better, make it easier, give me cool stuff to work, give me solutions to everyday problems I face, right? I get a check for monetization. Okay, whatever. It doesn't really change my life in any meaningful way. Or maybe you can protect my privacy to some extent. But by doing that, ironically, you're actually foreclosing me from being on the web and doing things I want to do, interacting in ways that I find fulfilling. And so the trade-off there is also probably not great for most people. So I believe that those are the sort of the two sets of use cases that have not yet worked. What I propose in the book and what a number of the companies as part of my coalition are now developing is this idea around solutions. And so I'll use Consumer Reports as a good example. So they are building out a set of AI agents, and they're one of our member companies. I'm thrilled to have them with us because they see a very different vision where they are the trusted intermediary to the average consumer. So they have something like 6 million users today of their services. And so they have two particular use cases we're looking at. I'll just mention the first one, which is customer service, right? I have been interacting with Verizon for years, and lo and behold, they owe me $20. But I've been trying my best to deal with them. I've been knocking on the door on their AI bot or their agent or trying to call somebody on the phone. I'm getting no help, right? So the problem is they want me as an individual consumer with no support system and limited time and patience to somehow go and get that money away from them. What Consumer Reports has decided, hey, you know, this is an area that a lot of consumers deal with every day. We can help make that better. And so an AI agent trained on me that has authorization to act as me, to go knock on the door as the agent to say, hey, I'm here on behalf of Richard. You owe him $20. And by the way, did I mention I'm here with Consumer Reports and they have 6 million users and they've got a brand that everybody recognizes and they could really piss off some people in Congress if you don't help. I mean, that's, of course, the subtext.
Right.
But the point is, you have a much greater chance of success there than you would if you're trying it on your own without that support system. And so lo and behold, more likely than not, Verizon will in fact pay you the $20 and then maybe Consumer Reports because 50 cents or something, whatever sort of a transaction fee. But from the consumer's viewpoint, it's like, wow, you save me time and money and effort. And you repeat that over and over again, not just there, but manage my subscriptions, give me a universal shopping cart that's super private that I can go look for stuff online on my terms. I mean, there's so many different ways that consumers can be empowered with the technology that we're just scratching the surface on. And so those are the business models worth pursuing because they deal with real world problems that people have that they want to have solved and that they will willingly pay in order to make that happen.
We're chatting with Richard Witt, author of the book Reweaving the Web on Hearsay Culture and KZSU-FM. So before we turn and close on a talk about your project and what you're doing in a concrete way to address this, right? You brought up agentic AI, right, and AI broadly, and I want to ask you a couple of things about that. One of the big issues, and it's a subtext in your book, of course, is the idea that, you know, we want to be in a world that human beings not only want to habitate, but can actually be happy in. And of course, the biggest concern, the media concern with regard to AI broadly, is the concern that people are going to lose their jobs, and they're not going to have opportunities to do other things. And on top of that, right, the companies creating the technologies seem to be, in a lot of ways, aloof to that problem, or at least not addressing it. And so I wanted to get your reaction to this interview on the Hard Fork podcast from about a month ago. The podcasters on Hard Fork interviewed Google DeepMind CEO Dennis Hassabis. They basically asked him a question with regard to early career and other individuals who are concerned about losing their jobs and about what their take or what his take was on that problem. Let me play you his answer to that question, Richard, and then I'd like to get your reaction to it.
You know, maybe it's starting to appear now. I don't think there's any hard numbers on that yet. At least I haven't seen it. I think for now, I mostly see these as tools that are augmenting what you can do and what you can achieve.
Now, this is an edited answer. I want to be clear. But I think it's reflective of a lot of the responses that I'm hearing when I see or hear CEOs of technology companies get interviewed. I saw NVIDIA's CEO just interviewed this morning on Morning Joe on MSNBC, and I didn't hear a clear answer to a few questions in that direction. What's your reaction, though, to this particular kind of answer and perhaps to this answer generally?
Yeah, I'm always a bit perplexed, although I shouldn't be, having lived in Silicon Valley here for a while and been in tech for 30 plus years. It's not that AI is coming for your job, right? It's that the companies behind AI are coming for your job, right? Artificial intelligence, and again, we use this in a very monolithic sense, but AI systems, AI agents, AI models, right? They are not some inevitable force of nature. They are creations of human beings. And there is this sense that, oh, once we unleash them in the world, oh my God, there's nothing we can do. We have to stand back and just let them do their thing, right? This is what I call technological determinism, right? It's this idea that once, if there's tech, if we can make it, we should make it, and then it achieves a life of its own. Of course, that's not true, right? They control the technology. The rest of us do not. And so whether they determine whether or not these technologies are fit for purpose to go and then fill jobs that otherwise would be filled by human beings, those are choices, right? Those are not inevitable outcomes because some technology is taking us over in sort of a matrix-like manner, right? So I do, it's perplexing, probably not surprising, because of course it benefits them in a sense to talk about these existential big time risks that people focus on, while these smaller things that I've been talking about, sort of the death by a thousand cuts, are happening every day with the agents that are creating AI slop and AI fraud and all of that that we're encountering on our devices. So anyway, that's sort of my reaction to that sort of mentality, is one all too common here, unfortunately, in the Valley. But I think there's no reason we need to give into it ourselves. I think we should push back and particularly say, okay, wait a minute. What are you doing, OpenMind, or anybody else, right? Deep, in terms of what you are doing, DeepMind, sorry, in this case, or OpenAI, right? How are you deploying the technology in ways that, at the end of the day, human beings have choice and agency? So agents represent them, for example, and not some sort of faceless, monolithic thing out there that is sort of taking over the world.
Yeah, you know, and of course, I the response to that point, right? The response has at least historically been in our lifetimes, we just create the technology, right? In fact, it's our responsibility to create the technology, right?
That's what they would say. But again, they create the technology, but they're creating the technology under the exact same paradigm that we've been talking about, the Siemens paradigm, right? It's one thing to build it and stick it in the middle of the street and say, okay, everybody, you know, play around with it, have fun, whatever. But they're not. They're installing it in their networks and then now in enterprises and large and small government agencies all over the world. And they're installing it under that particular paradigm, which is surveillance, extraction, analysis, manipulation. So they're giving into the exact same way the web platforms have constructed the cloud networks over the last two decades. I see no significant difference in terms of the viewpoint. So that is the mentality, the philosophy, the religion, if you want to call it, that's guiding the way that they put the technology out there. It's no such thing as a neutral technology, right? It is aimed in a particular way by the people behind it. That's the way they choose to put it in the world. So they can't claim to lack agency, ironically, over their agents, right? Because somehow it's got a life of its own, a force of its own, a force of nature that they can't control.
What do you make also, right, of implicit in the answer that Hassabis gave there, which is that, well, but, you know, there's all these great uses. And so whatever jobs that are lost, if they are going to be offset by new jobs and new opportunities, which you also hear. What's your take on that rationale and that explanation?
I mean, again, that's not necessarily untrue, but it is incomplete. Because it's all about, you know, what are the trade-offs ultimately they're talking about here? You could find the cure for cancer. That could be amazing. And that could be beneficial to a good part of the world. But in the process, if half the people in the United States, let's say, have lost their job over 10 years, is that the trade-off you want? Well, maybe, but that's not necessarily a trade-off they should be making unilaterally, sitting in their offices in the middle of Silicon Valley, right? That should be a societal decision. Maybe made in the political context, maybe made in terms of the way we talk about it every day over dinner tables, right? But it shouldn't be a unilateral conversation that they have within their own realm. So that's the part that I also push back on, that they are the ones who make these decisions, which comes back again to the technology should not be limited to them sitting in the cloud. It should be agents trained on me that work for me, that gives me a way to sort of right some of that power asymmetry so I can express myself and my viewpoints and have that power to do so in ways I can't today.
So in the few minutes that we have left, Richard, I do want to talk about this current effort you have, right, that you're launching and that you're bringing to ultimately address these issues, right? Because the begging question here is, okay, great, Richard, I buy your vision, right? And let's say I agree with everything you're saying. Okay, now how do we do it, right? And so you have at least one way to attempt to approach that, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, so I sketch out in the back of the book. So if people want to like go through all what I think of as sort of the fun historical and sci-fi stories and get to the nub of it, it's really the last four or five chapters where I say this is the how. And the how is a set of for-profit companies. I call it the Gliadnet Alliance, who get together and they figure out what are the binding policies and principles to be what I call a net fiduciary in the world. So an online company to be your intermediary to help protect your data and promote and enhance the way you are every day on the web and then even in your offline life, as the case may be. And so, you know, I lay out like why I think that this can work, because among other things, you can in fact make money at this. You can be successful. It's a market differentiator, particularly in the coming days, weeks, and months, where we've already seen the AI slop out there, right? It's everywhere. The low grade content that people are interacting with, half the time you don't know whether it's a real video or not. But now the AI fraud is going to come right behind that. So the fraudsters, the bad actors are going to use this technology to try to screw us over, right? Try to take our money. So I think it's all the more critical that we find these intermediaries who can work on our behalf, like the Consumer Reports, but the many other companies in my coalition and hopefully more are joining, who want to be that trusted intermediary. So in a world of 1,000 AI agents, for example, if one of them has a hand up saying, I'm a net fiduciary, meaning you can trust me, there's underlying binding principles in terms of what I do, and I have no conflicts of interest, I work for you, not for somebody else, that is something consumers can flock to. So the market can ultimately make the decision here. I'm a fan of markets, not necessarily modern capitalistic versions of markets and big corporations like the web companies, but markets in a smaller sense, willing buyers and sellers that also don't see us as always consuming and always buying, but just individuals who want to like enjoy their lives and do good things in the world with their families and communities. So anyway, that's sort of the vision. And these are the companies who thankfully, from my perspective, have bought into it, or we're building out the business models, the policies and practices. We ultimately want to get to a place where there's a trust mark of some sort, a code of conduct that people can see online and say, okay, now that's a trustworthy entity. It's backed by an enforceable regime, right? There's real recourse there. There's real teeth to the back end of it that people can then give authentic trust to. That's the vision. And that's Carla in 2032 in the back of the book. And that's the world that she inhabits.
Meanwhile, Richard, and I think those are great efforts, but meanwhile, right, technology is advancing at a breakneck pace and more or less it's operating in an almost unilateral, form of control by the companies creating it. So what do you say in closing, right, to let's say a second year law student, right, or a sophomore or junior, right, second or third year computer science person, or name more or less your young person entering, right, or wanting to enter the workplace? What do you say to them about how to approach the internet, how to approach AI, and where things might be? I'm not a futurist, and I'm asking you for a crystal ball, so I'm asking for what you'd say right now.
Yeah, well, hopefully my book gives one set of answers and at least some background that people can interact with and maybe understand a little bit better what's going on. I mean, ultimately, I'm a systems thinker, and so I'd encourage people to look at the systems we have in place today. The systems, again, much as we talked about technologies earlier, these are not monolithic forces of nature. These are just human beings, right? Human beings have put them together, hopefully with some intentionalities, oftentimes not the right intentionalities, at least it serves most of our interests. But if you look at the internet, look at the web, look at these technologies, AI, you know, AI platforms and the like, as a set of systems, then how do you pull back from that and find alternative systems that you want to build, that you want to interact with? So if you're, you know, if you're looking at, do I take that role with a, you know, the tech company that's building the, you know, the environment I'm not really fond of? That's one approach to your profession, but maybe think about it. What can I do building a startup, working with nonprofit groups, going into the government to encourage alternative market structures that can reflect, be a broader reflection of us as human beings that can hopefully change the web for the better? So that's what I would look for, those opportunities to create something new and better and different that you believe reflects your values, not necessarily the values of the companies that are predominant today.
Richard Witt, from the Glia Foundation and author of the book Reweaving the Web, How Together We Can Create a Human-Centered Internet of Trust. Thank you for joining us today. Again, terrific book for reference, but also terrific book to really kind of get back to these core ideas and to look for ways to actually solve these problems. Thank you for joining us on KZSU and the Hearsay Culture Network.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Check out hearsayculture.com, where we have a streamlined new website as well as new shows coming not only from Hearsay Culture Radio, but also from Denise Howell's Uneven Distribution, Denise and my show's R&D with D&D, and launching Secrets, my effort to bring trade secrecy into the foreground, but also to think about what we don't know, but what we might actually know more about than we realize. Come to us at hearsayculture.com. Please stay tuned to to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.